The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this June 27th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio, I believe. You can find us on Facebook under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter. I don't know how to do that because I don't do Twitter, but I hear we're out there probably under WOW. 88.9 KUCI, something like that. You can find us anywhere. No reason not to listen. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. And as you all know, I love the mornings when I get an author for the full hour. I'm on with Alexander Chi talking about essays and the autobiographical fiction. He is the best-selling author of the novels The Queen of the Night and Edinburgh. He is a contributing editor at the New Republic, at large, editor at large at the Virginia Quarterly Review, and a critic at large at the LA Times. His work has appeared in Best American Essays, The New York Times Magazine, Slate, Guernica, Tin House, others. He is an associate professor of English at Dartmouth College. His latest, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, is a collection of essays published by Houghton Mifflin. Alexander, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I was at Tin House 2 or 3 years ago, whenever we were there, and I got to catch glimpses of you. I got to hear a lecture of yours. So this is a treat. I was like, I got to talk more to this guy. That's good. So
thank you.
Yeah, this is great. So based on an essay in the collection, the autobiography of my novel, and a piece in The New Yorker recently, it sounds like this collection sort of came about, at least in part, after a book club discussion of Edinburgh, when you were sort of asked to remove the mask of fiction and answer whether the events in that book were autobiographical, which I always think is sort of an unfair question to ask a writer, but why you chose to write a novel as opposed to a memoir. Is that kind of generally how this collection was born in your mind?
Well, I think, the collection came about actually in a very different way, but it's true that the spirit of it, I think, was born during those first Q&As that I did as a debut author, you know, where you've like spent all this time working on your novel. You really have no idea what it's going to be like to go out and talk to people about this thing that's been in your head for years. And, you know, even if you've workshopped it and shared it with friends, nothing will prepare you for talking to the public except talking to the public. And people are, it's funny, you know, they read things and they feel this very intense possession of it. Sometimes when they read it, they feel like they know you so well that you must also, that you must also know them. Mm-hmm. And so they will often tell you things that are startlingly personal to them. And it's a very strange process that you end up in. And it's one that I've gotten used to and that I prepare for now when I have a book come out. But back then I wasn't ready for it. And I especially wasn't ready also for, I think, what turned out to be possibly a very American preoccupation, which is, you know, the reader who wants to know, like, how autobiographical is this work?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that is something that I found very strange as I was going around doing these, because as a reader, I had never wanted to know.
Right.
Like, not as in, like I had anything against knowing, but I just simply, I love novels so much, it never occurred to me to wonder if the person had lived through anything like it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that experience, I don't know that it's unique to you, but I think it's a little bit unique to you. I think I was looking at Amazon reviews about this book last night, and somebody said it's like going on the best first 5 dates of your life. And somebody else said, you know, it's just like listening to your best friend talk, the one you love, that doesn't judge you. And I think the sum of this reaction is a little bit unique to you and your writing style and your accessibility and your honesty. You know, I don't think every writer out there would get this confessional, I need to connect with you, I need to tell you these personal things about myself sort of reaction that you get. And what a testament that is to what you've done here.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that. I had not seen those reviews that you quoted from, which is part of why I laughed, because I find that absolutely amazing. The best of first 5 days.
I don't know why it was five exactly. It made me smile.
Yeah, thank you. That definitely made me smile. You know, I think there is this way though that when. I mean, I hear the autobiographical question all the time when I'm at events, when I'm listening to the radio, when I'm watching, writers be interviewed on TV. It's a very common question. And I'm just going to go out on a limb and say I think it's a mistake as a question. Because I think it's a way of talking about the writer that is also a way of not talking about what the writer has done, you know?
Right.
And I think that is an important thing to think about. The value of knowing, it seems to me, is very limited. I remember being a little confrontational in my first experiences with this question, that people asking it, and I would say things like, would you believe it more if it was true, if I told you it was all true? What would happen there? Blanche McCrary Boyd, who is a writer that I encountered very early in my career, she said something that I think about a lot. She has a new novel out, by the way, this spring that I want to mention. It's called The Tomb of the Unknown Racist. In any case, she said to me, and to our group of students at the Bennington Summer Writers Program, she said, if your nonfiction is good enough, people will think you made it up. And if your fiction is good enough, people will think that it all happened exactly just that way. And so there is a way in which these questions are kinds of compliments, you know, and I do take it that way. But for example, with The Queen of the Night, I remember reading from it a section where, you know, this is a novel about that I wrote about an opera singer in Second Empire France and Civil War America, who, you know, as a young girl, like has to bury her mother after her mother dies, because they are alone out on a farm together. And I read this scene, and afterwards, some wonderful little old lady came up to me and said, "I have to wonder if you really buried your mom." It's like, my mom's alive, thank you, don't worry. I have not actually ever buried anyone
yet. The day is young.
You know, these are the tricks, I suppose. So it's, you know, I think I'm not really bitter about this question. I have joked about, you know, how being on this being on tour with this book, at least I don't have to answer that question. but anyway, the question for how the essay collection came together is actually very different, which is, you know, I just felt like it was time to have an essay collection, and I had been invited to read at a nonfiction series at Columbia University, at their MFA program, by the writer Liz Harris. And when I wrote back to her, I said, you know, I don't really have a book of nonfiction. And she said, I know. She said, I still want you to come. It's just, I looked at the posters for the series and noticed that basically everyone who was coming had many books of nonfiction, or at least a few. And so I set about, you know, putting a list of my favorite essays together for her. And as I did, I noticed that it looked like a table of contents. And that got me thinking.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, going back to your prior point, I have to say I couldn't help but sort of think about that Junot Diaz essay in The New Yorker that came out, I guess, right before his sort of reckoning. But a similar experience where, you know, somebody wanted to know the autobiographical nature of his novel, which he denied at the time. But I think this individual was reaching out to him as a, you know, life raft sort of, does somebody out there really understand me? And, you know, I think that is sort of the power of what both fiction and nonfiction can do. Is sort of throwing these lifelines out to people who need a connection and who feel understood through fiction, who have finally found themselves in between the pages of a book. And I just think that's very cool and powerful and, you know, kind of the flip side of the dark, prurient, nosy side of whether or not things are autobiographical or not, which I do normally think is sort of an inappropriate question.
I think that, you know, there's an interesting form of Japanese writing called I fiction, which is a kind of autobiographical 20th century version of autobiographical fiction writing, which, as I understand it, like, part of the conceit of it is that everyone agrees that it is autobiographical, and also everyone agrees that they're all going to pretend as if it has all been made up. Or not pretend exactly, but they will discuss it that way, so that at least one doesn't have to make it so personal, in a sense. Uh-huh. You know, my biography this morning feels a little limited in relationship to discussing that particular aspect. So maybe I'll say instead, like, yes, you know, we write these things so that people can connect actually to themselves. At least that's what I think.
Yeah.
And to other people also. I think when they want to connect to us as the writer of it, it can be consoling, it can be enlivening. You know, there's times when I get mail from readers and I think, it just absolutely is the exact thing that I need to read in that moment, where someone just said something so incredibly kind or wonderful to me, you know, just like the Amazon reviews that you read. And then sometimes it can feel really, especially if it's in person, it can feel very, sometimes it can feel like you've been, attacked isn't really the right word, but like you've been, you know, that essay that you're talking about, just for the listeners who don't know, begins with me at a book club meeting and discussing my first novel, which is about sexual abuse, and the questioner asking me, you know, if this is an autobiographical novel, like, why didn't she just write a memoir?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And acting as if I had somehow cheated him of something or shortchanged him or, you know, it was a very strange question to be confronted with, especially in a discussion about a book, because it wasn't really about the book. It was about something else. It was acting as if I had done something kind of lesser. And so in that sense, I think it did feel like an attack in that instance, and that is part of why I reacted the way I did.
Right.
You know, I think the way that people address their own abuse and how much they're willing to talk about it is something that, you know, yes, ideally it would be left for them to discuss, to decide. And in fact, what I've found to be the case is that, you know, if you do admit to it, everybody has opinions about how you've handled it, whether you've handled it correctly, and so on, in ways that are actually, like, incredibly upsetting to discuss. And so it's, you know, it's never been my experience that talking about it has resulted in people being, at least automatically, you know, my being able to assume that they will be kind about it, or even sensitive to the concerns. And so, you know, when you write fiction about that kind of an experience, it's very specifically different. And I think that is, you know, I'm not, the Diaz essay isn't fresh in my mind, so I'm not really remembering the aspect that you are discussing, but it sounds as if someone was asking him if he had really gone through that himself personally.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I think that question can feel like an invasion.
Right. Right. Yeah, I do think that fiction can do... you have a beautiful line in the book about you don't know who you are until you put on a mask, and how fiction can be helpful for everybody, probably, if it's fictionalized. I think it can do things that autobiography or memoir cannot do, and allow you to speak truths that maybe facts don't adhere to, but truth adheres to a little bit better than nonfiction. But we should say that
I don't know if it's better exactly. Mm-hmm. I think it's about giving yourself the space, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
To move outside of yourself.
Right. Right.
That's how it feels like to me.
Yeah. Right. Right. We should say that this book is really like three or four books in one. I mean, it's wonderful for writers. It's got a lot of writing advice. You worked with the great Annie Dillard and other really wonderful writers and yourself with all of your wonderful writing advice. And then it's, you know, novelistic, it's memoiristic, it's so much contained in these essays that I don't even know how you managed it. And it feels incredibly cohesive from beginning to end. It felt very bookended and, you know, operatic in scope, sort of. So it was such an accomplishment.
Thank you.
I don't think it's any coincidence, or you can talk about whether or not, that you opened the collection in Mexico and you closed it in America, in the U.S. And I feel like, I mean, it was chronological, but it was also chronologically thematic. I don't know if those two are the same thing, but kind of, I know a lot of these essays were decades in the making or decades in the drawer and then came out and were made again. Maybe you can describe this better than I'm doing and kind of talk about sort of the scope of the essays, how they came together a little bit more.
Sure. When I sat down to do this, I was also doing my tenure review and realized that I had written, you know, something on the order of like 60 essays in the last 20 some years of my writing career. And so, you know, as I thought about what I would include and what I would not include, I also noticed, or rather, I noticed and knew that I had essays that were unfinished. And so what's here is a mix of those. There's, I think if I remember this correctly, there's 6 that were in my archives, and then there are 10 that have been published previously. And, you know, one was, like, the first one, The Curse, was actually first published as a short story, and I decided to transform it back into, you know, just my experiences. Hmm. Turn it into an essay. And I like it much better. I think it's the right thing to have done. Hmm. That was probably the most, is that right? Possibly the most rehabilitated. The autobiography of my novel essay was a part of a kind of monster draft that also included another essay called The Guardians. And those were my attempts to write about writing and sexual abuse. And they really did, I think, need to be 2 essays. And I'm very happy with them now. I seemed unable to create the kind of larger, you know, essay megaplex, novella-length thing that was underway at the time. And what else? Parade, which is a very short account of a police riot in San Francisco, mm-hmm. began as a short short that I had written and submitted in 1992 to a story magazine fiction contest, and I won a typewriter.
That's awesome.
That I then used to write on for a few years until I bought my first Mac.
I love that typewriters are making a big comeback right now. It's great. I know some people that are totally obsessed with going back and it's slowing down, and, you know, typewriting is sort of like handwriting. It just, you have to slow down. You can't whip it out the way you can on your Mac. So I think they're fun for that.
Also, the only notifications you get are the sounds of the typewriter as you write.
Right.
So, like, the keys, the bell when you hit the end of the sentence, and then it returns, you know, which is apparently a powerful motivator for a lot of people, that bell. You know, I think it's a instrument for communicating only with yourself, you know.
Yeah, right.
There's no sudden arrival of an email from a friend who immediately needs to process something with you, or a news alert about a presidential tweet. There's just none of it, and that's, I think, why. You know, I remember learning that programmers actually use, like, they write all of these programs on a program that has none of these notifications. And I remember thinking, like, I can't believe you guys are doing this to us, you know, like creating these tools that are so full of interruptions, you know. Mm-hmm. Ever since, like, Clippy the paperclip from, right, like, you know, it looks like you're writing something. Do you need some help with that? Like, oh, my God. It just, like, that was so, it just made me not want to write at all, you know.
Right.
Or be a writer or be associated with it, you know.
It's so funny.
It's too much.
It's too much. It's interesting. So Rebecca Mackay was on last week with her latest release, The Great Believers.
Yeah.
It is great. And as I was reading your collection and I was reading The Great Believers, I was thinking, I wonder if we now are getting to the distance of 30 or 40 years of what the AIDS epidemic meant in this country, of our kind of reckoning with that, if we needed that sort of distance to start talking about it. It just felt sort of, I don't know, coincidental that this conversation is kind of coming up to the forefront, and I don't know if it's a reaction to what's now going on in our our great, once great nation, or if writers sort of need those decades to process what's happened. But it's timely, and I think it's the right time to start talking about some of these issues.
Well, first of all, thank you. I think, you know, there are writers who have grappled with it. The question is, like, how has it broken through into the mainstream? I think, you know, there is a way in which the world is queerer now in general, that, like, you know, there's much more acceptance of LGBTQI people. There's, we're human to the general public in a way that we haven't been before. And so our struggles are human to them. And so, the literature actually can, literature that's written about it now can get that attention in a way that it didn't before. You know, at the time that this was happening, people were definitely writing about it. And even in the first decade, people were writing about it. Writers like Sarah Schulman, especially, for example, and, of course, Larry Kramer, John Weir. You know, John Weir's novel, The Irreversible Decline of Eddie Socket, is one of the first really important novels about AIDS. I think. Mm-hmm. And the sort of the ways in which those books stay in the public's mind and so on, I think it's a complicated thing. I think that it's not so much that enough time has passed, you know, for this issue to now be dealt with in fiction. I think it's more like writers writing about it now are less likely to be ignored. Huh. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. It's interesting. There was a theme of, as I was reading through these, there's a recurring reference of metaphors to parade and circus and masks. And I noticed so many mentions of parade. It was just interesting to me.
Oh, gosh.
No, it's good. It's a wonderful thing.
Okay.
But, you know, kind of sort of dissecting the writer's subconscious of what enduring metaphors and the masks we wear and the, you know, lying was also a big thing. The lies we tell ourselves and kind of shaving those lies away to get to something truer. Which kind of led me to the, you know, the mask metaphor and whatnot. And I was wondering if you get a sense when you're writing, because if you, you know, if a person lies to themselves over and over and that kind of becomes their truth, how do you know as a writer when you've actually gotten to the truth? Does that make sense? Like, how do you know when you've scraped away?
When you write the essay. just kidding.
How do you know when you've done the work?
Well, I mean, that's the job, you know, is that, I mean, sometimes you don't know, it's perilous. There's not really a heuristic that can be offered that saves you from that, from like, you know, any of your own self-deceivings. I will say that, you know, my writing process is definitely, built around a deep suspicion of myself, like, oh, so you think you believe that? That's interesting. Let's find out, you know. And certainly it's been the case that the things that I've learned, that the things that I am the most sure of are the things that I absolutely have to research and fact check. Because they're most often the things that I have in my blind spot. And that is probably its own essay, to be honest.
It's interesting. Just to that point, yeah. I was just going to say to that point, Rebecca Mackay was talking last week about that empathy can only take you so far. And I think, and the importance of research and how she had the exact same experience writing fiction as you're describing writing memoir of being suspicious of your allowing sort of emotion, empathy, and memory to control things as opposed to hardcore research. She was just making that point from the other side. And I think that's kind of an interesting corollary between fiction and nonfiction and the importance of research, and relying on your own, your own mind as opposed to the external, check of research.
People think that we don't research these things. But we do. And in fact, it's more often than a novel is fact-checked than a book of nonfiction, weirdly.
Hmm.
But, you know, the copy editor goes through a fact-check with you. And we'll send you things like, you know, queries like, so, you know, on this day in that year, this was happening, and that means that this wouldn't have happened this way, you know. Like the really intense copy editors,
mm-hmm.
are people like that who, it's sort of like they're the pit crew for your novel, going through and like testing to make sure the tires are gonna just explode as you go around the curve, and. I'm incredibly grateful for that kind of copy editor. I think it's like they're not just in there fixing sentences, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing that I have started doing when teaching writing actually is to give my students research assignments, actually, to ask them prompts like, what do you not know that you should know to write this story? And then they make lists, and then I send them to an appointment with the departmental librarian who teaches them how to look for what they're looking for.
Hmm. So. That's a good one. People don't know what librarians are anymore. So that right there is important.
They really don't. And, you know, a Google search is so often just like, you know, when you're doing research on a particular topic, the Google search that you do is so often just kind of like reiterations from Wikipedia spread across like dozens of junk sites.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And it can be such a waste of your time or a false reassurance on something. Sometimes you are going to also run into the blind spots of the internet where you should never imagine that that everything has been digitized and can be searched through Google or search engines.
Right.
It hasn't, you know, and so that's where librarians are astonishingly helpful.
Yeah. My guess
and in particular, you know, the one we have at Dartmouth, for example, is Wendell Cox, who I work with there in the English department. He's our departmental librarian. He is a ninja of information searching. So it's like really remarkable to like learn from him.
That's a great title, the ninja of information searching. That's good. We'd all aspire to that. My guest this morning is Alexander Chi, the book How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. Two of these essays are written in, I will give a station ID. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Two of these essays are written in list form, and I think there's some power whether or not the essay remains in list form or it's, there's something really powerful about making lists or breaking out of form. And, I don't know what your experience was with that, but I was wondering if you could talk about that and sort of the power of breaking form and the power of maybe writing something out in a list and if that was the way these essays were always going to come out or a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the great thing about a list is that it asserts a connection between the things that are on the list in a way that few other forms can. And so as the reader of it, you are brought into this relationship with it because the things are in a list and you are going down the list. And so that is probably like the most simple kind of like brute power of the list as a literary form, like whether it's a list poem or a list essay or there are list stories. And I think that was part of what I was after was that power in those two essays, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I say this because at the time that I wrote them, I thought, well, if I put these in a list, then this will definitely succeed. But I think it's more like at the time that I was writing each of them, I thought, oh, I will make a list. And there's a certain fun to the list because you can play with readerly expectations in an entirely different way. And mm-hmm. you can make, radical departures or radical intimacies in these kinds of associations. So
yeah.
I think that's probably for me the fun of it. You know, for playing with form, I think, I do like to borrow from other forms, music or visual arts, and I think that that's just the nature of art,
It's funny you should say that. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Say.
I was going to say it's funny you should say that because I've been having so my husband's a photographer and he is showing this festival with all sorts of different artists, wood turners and painters and whatever, and the conversations amongst the artists and the conversations I'm having with them from the writing perspective, it's amazing the similarities of what everyone is concerned about in art and point of view and balance of light versus dark and I don't know. I mean, it kind of goes on and on that all of us are thinking about how to get at something in drastically different ways, but the conversations are all the same. And so I think if a writer sets out intentionally to your point of trying to borrow from music or visual arts, it lends such a different texture and power to the writing if you just think about it from your own perspective as a writer or your own perspective, if you broaden your mind, it can do really interesting things in your writing, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also that power of making a connection between things that have not been connected before, which is one of the things that we enjoy about any, I think, artistic medium, right, is that feeling of being surprised by something that we think we know.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I enjoy doing, I don't know if you'll enjoy doing it, but I do it particularly in short story form, is to take one of your essays and sort of dissect it and, take it from initial kernel of thought through a kind of its evolution, revision process, how it changed, and some of the artistic decisions that you may have made with it. We can choose any essay. I was kind of thinking of Rosary.
Sure. That's a great one.
Can do anyone that makes sense. But sort of when you started writing it and kind of, your first thoughts, how you got into it, what the point of entry idea-wise was for it, and just kind of walk us through the evolution of the essay. Maybe we should introduce it first so people even know what we're talking about.
Sure, yeah. Let's do it. So the essay is called The Rosary, and for those interested, there's an excerpt of it online at thenewyorker.com. Hmm. And it is about It's about roughly about an 8-year period when I lived in an apartment in Brooklyn, New York, that had a backyard that I turned into a rose garden. And so the whole essay essentially is about that. It's about that experience, but it's also about me turning into the person who wrote my first novel, which was the thing that I was also doing there at the same time. And, you know, one thing that I saw much later after I had left that place was that rose gardening had given me a lot in relationship to that writing, that had taught me a kind of patience with something difficult. And the first thing that you're really supposed to do as a gardener is to keep a garden journal. I don't know if people know that, but anyway, the reason being that gardens are essentially drafts. Every year it's a new draft, really. Hmm. And so you're taking notes always about the seasons and what the plants are doing in relationship to each other, the pests that you're encountering, so that there's a record of how you handle those things. And it's also about learning how much light you get in different seasons and where the light falls and where it doesn't fall and how you might have to adjust the garden around that. It's really a kind of nicely contemplative sort of writing to do, you know, and I think there's a tremendous pleasure in it. So when I learned that this was the sort of gardening book that I had was encouraging me to take up this practice, so I began keeping a garden journal. And I am not a particularly regular journal keeper. I can, in fact, if I open the one on my computer right now, which I'm sitting in front of, I can tell you that the last entry was March 2nd.
Better than mine.
and the entry begins, "Hello, my irregular friend." So it's something that I do so infrequently. And so when I do it regularly, and then I'm able to look back on the time captured within it, I'm very grateful, you know, for that as material, essentially, for writing. Yeah. And so I looked in on this gardening journal and thought, this should really be an essay about teaching myself to grow roses in Brooklyn. And, you know, as the essay says, you know, before I began the process, I didn't really have any experience or seeming aptitude for gardening, and especially for rose gardening. And so I set out trying to turn this into an essay, which was a process that ended up taking over a decade. So I'm sorry there's so much laughter in this interview.
No, it's good.
That's just how all of my interviews are like that, I think. So the process was that I was working on this essay about rose gardening for a while, and the funny part was that my agent's husband actually is someone who really loves roses, and I had talked about the essay with him at a party, and suddenly my agent was like, "You have an essay about roses?" And so then she started asking about it, and that became this thing that she regularly asked about. And so I kept saying that I was almost done, almost done, almost done. And the essay was very hard to write. You know, it was partly because I couldn't figure out where the story was. And that's partly because a journal doesn't have a story. A journal is just a journal. It's just a record of things. And so I had to find the stories – in it and try to bring that out. And so it took probably almost as long as creating the garden to do that. But, you know, I think it's also that it never felt particularly urgent to finish either. There was always something else that was more important writing-wise to finish. And a lot of my essays ended up being like that, where I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll get back to it. And then, you know, 3 months, 6 months go by. And, you know, when you're teaching, the teaching terms are very intense and the demands are intense. And so you end up having to do your writing in a few months, a year when you're not teaching. But the problem with that then is that you don't really get a vacation. So then the things that you're writing are ruining all of your vacations. and that's the sort of thing that I've had to try to work out in general as a writer. But back to the finishing of the rose gardening essay, essentially, I thought, okay, now I will finally finish this essay. And just basically chose including it in the collection as a way to make sure that it was finally done.
There's some great images in there of, like, you live in New York, so your neighbors are hanging underwear outside, and, like, these panties yeah. are sort of drifting into your garden, and somebody clearly has buried their dog in a house coat or bathrobe or something. And so, I don't know, there's just these images in there that are very visceral. I don't know what they all mean, but they're very enduring. Yeah, you had talked at some point about struggling with plot. And I do think a lot of, you know, new writers, you get so caught up in making sure the words are beautiful and the phrases are nice and the sentences are lovely that you kind of, I think a lot of new writers forget that you also have to have the momentum of plot. And so I really appreciated some of your conversations about that. I do think it's a trap that, or I don't know, a trap that... writers can get caught into that, you know, you have to have so many balls moving at the same time. It's a challenge, but plot is hard for a lot of them.
Yeah, it's whether or not it's plot, there should be that plot or transformation, I think, is how I explain it to my students. A sense that, you know, there's that kind of story where at each point in the story, you discover you are in a very different story from the story you thought you were in. And that's how the story moves, is that it keeps revealing that you think you are in this story, and now you are in this other story, and now you're in this other story, and so on. And gradually by the ending, you realize you have been inside of something else entirely. And finally, the fullness of whatever it is revealed to you. So plot really, or transformations, and, you know, so sometimes those intersect and you have both, you know, but I think, The Secret History, for example, by Donna Tartt is a great example of something that has both a plot and also proceeds through these transformations. Mm-hmm. I think, what is often sometimes referred to as a plot twist, you know, is actually this revelation that the story you thought you were in is not the story that you're in.
Is there an essay in this book that it jumps out at you in particular as starting out as the story you thought you were in and then changed significantly to a different story?
I mean, sure. I think probably most of them, you know, you know, this may also be a good description of an essay, a personal essay at least. I think it's very rare to begin an essay thinking, I know what this is, and then proceed all the way to the end, knowing what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you write an essay to explore an idea, and you succeed most when you are open to understanding that the idea is not the idea that you thought you had, or it's, you know, that there are all these ways that there are layers and depths and surprises and so on that you're encountering. I think in the revision process, you know, in terms of revising things that were already published, certainly the essay on the tarot, The Querent, is the one where I revised the beginning pretty dramatically and understood that I had missed a kind of important part of the puzzle.
What was that?
Oh, well, you know, that I had had this very significant encounter with a parapsychologist,
okay.
And I had just not brought it up. And so I was, as a result, reading tarot cards more the way, say, a psychic would, as opposed to how you would read tarot cards just being like a tarot card reader who may or may not be psychic.
It's interesting. There was some, I can't remember which essay it was in, but you talked about wanting to find a therapist, and the therapist you found said, you know, you've so digested everything you've been through your writing that I can't help you. I don't know why I thought that was inside. Well, I don't know, but I'm wondering if writing, it allows you to understand things about your situation that I think you probably wouldn't if you didn't write through it. I mean, I think that's what a lot of writers write for. But then to try and seek out professional help and they say, I can't help you because you've already done the work on your own. I don't know why it struck me as sort of funny, but I wonder.
Yeah, writing is not therapy, you know. I think that's, yeah. No, it is, it's both funny and also, like, and also difficult and something that I think that we need to all really think about, because I think there is therapeutic writing to do. You know, it's been discovered in studies that writing about the pain that you have as a patient can help you heal that pain. That doesn't mean that it should become published writing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, for people who are writing about trauma, I actually recommend that they do private writing first about it, and then out of that make decisions about what they want to share in any other more public sphere, so that they're not, say, trying to heal themselves as they're trying to write an essay about this thing that has happened to them. Because I think that is something that can go on for a very long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the therapist, I think, you know, in her defense, she was used to people who were simply, as she said, like, just not even able to describe what had happened to themselves. Much less write a novel about it. And so, to her mind, I was doing fine. But talking about something isn't the same as having recuperated from it. And it's certainly not the same as having investigated the patterns of it, you know, in your life.
Right.
And the way it affects you, you know.
Right.
So, you know, it's, I think the, you know, one of the things that I saw, for example, through therapy was that I had this pattern of having, you know, someone that I loved in my life and then someone else that I would have sex with, and I would keep them separate. Mm-hmm. And that was a part of that kind of the bifurcation that had been created in my mind, this kind of sense of two people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to sort of figure out that this thing that I thought was basically, like, you know, a shortcoming of mine was actually, like, something that had been born out of these experiences and was also something that I could address, reconcile, and so on. But that didn't come about through writing. That came about through therapy.
I really like this point of telling writers that there's a difference, because I do think a lot of writers don't recognize the importance of that difference and what private writing versus public writing, the two very different jobs those things are, and not trying to blend them. I think that's an important discussion.
Especially now with social media, I think there's lots of people who are chronicling their lives on social media, and it might seem like they're oversharing, but in fact, if they were to go back and look at what they've shared, they would probably see that they have written things that are really incomplete, that don't tell the whole story, and that certainly don't tell themselves the whole story. And for writers, I think, the incredible Mavis Gallant, for example, who so many of us writers worship, she kept a diary rigorously, and we are all now waiting for some sort of volume of these diaries to come out in print now that she has passed. Because the ones that we've seen excerpted are stunning meditations on her life and her circumstances. And it's easy to see how they served as a reservoir for this other writing that she did that made her the writer that we love.
I can't believe we're out of time. This is killing me. I have a thousand other questions. I will say I usually end with asking you about writing advice, but my advice to our listeners is to pick up the book, because it is brimming with wonderful advice from you, from writers you've studied with. So I will just highly recommend How to Write the Autobiographical Novel for about a dozen reasons or more. Anyway, Alexander Chi, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for making the time for me, and to your listeners for making the time for this.
Thank you. That was Alexander Chi. The book, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, is out and available now. That's all we have time for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.